From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At 8 p.m. Eastern Time tonight, President Trump's travel ban will partly take effect 3 days after a portion was given the green light by the Supreme Court. So, as it stands, everyone with visas already will be allowed in. But after 8, people from 6 Muslim-majority countries and refugees without bona fide family or business ties to the U.S. will not be allowed to get a new visa and come in down the road. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly joined House Speaker Paul Ryan at Ryan's weekly news conference this morning. Now, the House votes today on 2 bills pertaining to illegal immigration. Here's some of what Kelly said.
President Trump has been clear that our borders are not open to illegal immigration, that we are a nation of laws, and we will no longer look the other way. Well, we will no longer look the other way in the interior either.
So that was about immigration, but Kelly left the news conference before taking any questions about the travel ban, which, of course, concerns legal immigration. Joel Rose is NPR National Desk Correspondent. He covers immigration. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Robin.
Now, it's the court that used the phrase bona fide, you know, these ties that somebody has to have to the U.S. Then a cable was sent out yesterday describing what that means. You've been talking with Homeland Security officials. What are they saying about how officials around the world giving out these visas are supposed to define what this bona fide relationship is?
Right. The administration held a background call for reporters not long ago, and the administration is talking about new guidelines for visa applicants from these 6 majority Muslim countries. Travelers will be allowed to enter the U.S. if they have close family ties. That's defined as a parent-in-law, a spouse, a child, adult son or daughter, and sibling. That also includes son-in-law, daughter-in-law, half and step-siblings. But the definition does not include grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, cousins, fiancés, and other extended family members. So, you know, it's... They've drawn the line right on bona fide, you know, relationship in a particular way, which they say was drawn from, you know, the Immigration and Nationality Act and from the language of the Supreme Court order itself.
And for some people, a grandparent might be their closest relationship, but according to this definition now, it doesn't count. And I'm thinking, too, this does apply to refugees. Wouldn't it be harder for refugees coming into the U.S. to have a close relationship here?
That's right. You know, a great percentage of refugees have no ties in the U.S. before they settle here. Many do have some kind of family relationship, as much as 50%, according to the administration officials on the call. But it's not really clear how many of those will qualify as a close family relationship under these new definitions that they're laying out here.
Yeah. Finish the thought.
Well, yeah. I should point out that refugees who are scheduled to travel to the country through July 6th are still allowed in. As you say, after that, the administration says they're going to have to show a close relationship, just like visa holders.
Right. Okay. Well, when the travel ban was first implemented, suddenly there was chaos at airports. This was back in January, because it did include everybody, whether or not you had a visa. That shouldn't happen tonight.
Well, the administration is saying it should not happen tonight. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security says they're expecting business as usual. And there are actually a couple of reasons to expect that this will be less chaotic. The State Department says people who already have visas in hand can use them to travel, that no one is going to have a visa canceled in the air this time, which I think was a big source of confusion in January during the first travel ban. And any refugee who's scheduled to be resettled through July 6th, as I just said, is going to be allowed to come in. But that said, Amnesty International immigrant rights activists are going to be watching carefully to see what happens here. They're dispatching lawyers and translators to airports to monitor exactly how this is going to be rolled out. They did the same thing back in January when thousands of people were stranded or detained at airports. And so we may see some friction again, but, you know, if not, it may not be tonight. I mean, it may be over the coming days as this unfolds.
Well, now remember that these bans were temporary for travelers, I think 90 days, for refugees, maybe a little more, 120. But what's your sense of what's going to happen? Is the administration going to change the rules after those 90 or 120 days? The Supreme Court is supposed to hear arguments about the full travel ban in October. But is there a sense, we've heard that there's thinking that that might be moot by then if the entire thing is dropped? What's your sense?
Well, you know, I don't I don't know exactly where this is heading. I mean, remember that the states and the immigrant rights lawyers who challenged the travel ban in the first place were successful in blocking the order because judges on both coasts agreed that there was a chance it was unconstitutional because it's a ban on Muslims. So, you know, the administration's lawyers argued that the injunctions issued by those lower courts prevented them from doing the security review that had been the, you know, the original justification for this temporary travel ban in the first place. So the administration says they have not been able to go, were not able to go forward with that security review while the travel ban was on hold. So they say that review only got underway very recently. So I think, you know, it's hard to say.
NPR's Joel Rose, a National Desk correspondent covering immigration. Joel, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, in Houston, a member of the notoriously violent MS-13 street gang has been arrested and charged with the murder of a student last November. Jairo Chicas Raimundo was also charged with murdering a rival gang member 2 days earlier. Police say he was in the country illegally and had been on the run for months until investigators found him this week. The pull of gang life is strong for some young Central Americans who often come to the U.S. without their families. But once in, getting out of a gang isn't easy or safe. Armando Truhl of Here and Now contributor WAMU reports on a program in Northern Virginia that's helping former gang members start over, including erasing the tattoos that kept them bonded to their gangs.
Plastic surgeon Carol Shapiro is prepping her 18-year-old patient Juan before she starts removing one of his tattoos with a laser scalpel. Juan doesn't want his full name used because he's an ex-gang member.
It hurts like hell. You need to understand that.
Both Juan and Shapiro are wearing goggles to protect their eyes. Juan has a rubber ball to squeeze if the pain becomes too intense.
If you want me to stop, just say stop, but please don't move.
The laser's red beam traces the outline of playing cards on the patient's forearm. The pulsing beam is like a tiny pinprick hammering and breaking down the ink. Shapiro tells Juan the ink will then be absorbed into his bloodstream and then eliminated through his urine. Next door is the man who made the procedure possible.
By the time they come to us, they've left the gang. They've done all the hard work. They've left the gang. And the tats are their remaining evidence of the fact that they were gang involved.
Rich Buchholz runs the gang response intervention team in Prince William County, Virginia. He says the tattoo removal program has treated 40 former gang members in the past 9 years.
They come because they are looking to be able to get a job and they know that this is going to hold them back. Some come because they want to join the military. And some have had children, little kids, and they tell me that, you know, the little kids are asking about those tattoos and they're embarrassed that they've got them and they want to get rid of them.
Buchholz is no pushover. He doesn't make it easy for the ex-gang members to erase their tats.
They write a statement as to why they want their tattoos off. They have to do 50 hours of community service. They have to, you know, to give back to the community. They have to be free of any gang association for 6 months. They can't have any new criminal charges for 6 months. They have to be in school and getting passing grades.
And when they're accepted, Buchholz warns them it's just the beginning. They're going to be monitored throughout the months-long process, and it's going to hurt a lot.
All right, if it's really painful, you may take Tylenol or ibuprofen.
Next door in the recovery room, a nurse is slathering antiseptic on Juan's arm while giving him post-op instructions. After she leaves, I ask him about the playing card tattoo. The skin all around it is red and swollen with bloody little dots like pinpricks.
Estas son cartas, la oración sobre las cartas, red.
He describes the tattoo as playing cards with prayers, a gang symbol of how life is a game of chance, where winners live and losers die. The prayer asks for life. Juan has tattoos all over his body, tombstones with names of friends he says have been killed, the name of his gang affiliation on his chest. He says he joined the gangs in El Salvador when he was 11, and the tattoos started shortly thereafter. I think my old life is behind me, he says. I don't want reminders of a past life. Don't want trouble or people to be afraid of me when they see the tats. I want to take advantage of the opportunities this country has to offer, he adds. Buchholz says he's heard many variations of Juan's explanation over the years.
The key thread is that they realize they made a mistake.
In recent months, as gang violence and murders have increased in Northern Virginia, the tattoo removal program has taken on more urgency, just as tattoos can prevent former gang members from joining the military or getting a job. Buchholz says they can also make them a target for those still in a gang.
I think that we're keeping them safe because obviously gang tattoos can put a person in danger. I think I'm helping society, actually. I think I'm helping the community at large.
Buchholz says so far the tattoo removal program is working. He says none of his 40 patients have returned to the gang life, and only one has had even a minor brush with the law. For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl.
This week, three police officers in Chicago were indicted, accused of lying about a fellow officer's fatal shooting of the black teen Laquan McDonald in 2014. On Tuesday, a white police officer in St. Louis shot and wounded an off-duty black officer who'd come to his aid. The Black Police Union said there is a perception that a black man is automatically feared. And this week, the family of Philando Castile reached a nearly $3 million settlement with the city of St. Anthony, Minnesota, after Officer Geronimo Yanez was acquitted in the shooting death of Castile at a traffic stop. Castile told Officer Yanez he had a gun. A passenger said Castile reached for his wallet. Officer Yanez shot him, saying he feared for his life. We spoke with an emotional John Thompson, a friend of Philando Castile's. We'll link you at herenow.org. He sobbed throughout, said he had no sympathy for a scared police officer. That's the job. Well, today we want to hear from Dustin Reichert, a retired sheriff's deputy from Minneapolis. We called him because he blogged from the Yanez trial. As you'll hear, there's more to his story. Hi, Dustin.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. And a tender topic here. Lots of tears, lots of pain, and lots of not understanding the verdict. People can't understand how a driver can give a warning that he has a gun that he was legally carrying, say he's not pulling it out, and then be shot.
It's not as simple, I think, as everybody's saying. There's a difference between saying and verbalizing what you're going to do and what you physically do as an act. What we have here is the perception of Officer Yanez hearing the verbal part about the gun, but seeing a different action.
Well, and to those who would say that this is an issue of African-Americans being shot by officers. In fact, there have been 15 high-profile cases of black men shot by police or dying in police custody, only two convictions. You would say what?
I'd say that we need to be careful. We have to break them down by an individual. There are a different set of training. There are different state requirements.
Well, that's kind of funny because I thought you were going to say that you have firsthand knowledge. You were in a very different situation because in your case, a man raised a gun and pointed it at you. You shot and killed?
Correct, yes.
What's that moment like?
You know, it is scary. There is a lot of fear in there. I know there's a lot of discussion with the Officer Yanez case about fear and scariness. That doesn't mean we're not going to do our job, but yeah, there was a lot of fear there. Just in the middle of it, as fast as it went, which was about 5 to 8 seconds, and I think the moment the first bullet hit me, everything slowed down, like almost the Matrix.
Well, yeah, you're also adding that you were hit. He shot you.
Yes. You know, when I had already hit him with what turned out to be a lethal shot, and he was still able to get two rounds to hit me, and when that first one hit me, I thought, oh, I just got, and before I could say the word shot, the second one hit me. And so much happens. My gun went flying. I'm watching it going flying. I'm trying to visually see it so I can get to it to protect myself. And, you know, my son's running. I have a 4-year-old child at the time. And my son's running through my head. And my nephew and niece grew up without a father because he had passed away. And I just kept resonating with my head as I was trying to crawl to safety.
No. Just a horrible moment. I mean, you got to always be thinking, that's possible. I mean, is that part of it, that the police are so painfully aware that that is possible, that you might always think it's possible, even when it would be impossible to the person standing looking at you? They would never even consider that.
Yeah, that whole time, this isn't going to happen. He's not going to shoot me, but I have to continue tactically And the entire time until the point that he had that gun pointed straight at me, I thought there's no way he's going to shoot me.
And then he did.
Yes.
And you were both white.
Yes, correct. I often wonder, had that been an African-American man in his doorway pointing, not necessarily how the prosecutor would have taken it, but I wonder how the media would have taken it. I think it's a great example. Less you guys, but I do believe mainstream media makes this stuff worse.
Well, but you know, we're also criticized for not paying enough attention to the number of blacks shot until videos surfaced. Look, you tell us police aren't celebrating the acquittal of Officer Yanez, that the case, even with an acquittal, is having a chilling effect?
Yeah, you know, the conversations that I have are pain, frustration. I think everybody understands and sees why the family of Castillo would be hurt. I think the frustration is that they don't see that an officer would want to protect themselves. We're at the point now where it's going to be tough second guessing, if I pull this car over, do I have to worry about defending myself? Do I have to worry about being prosecuted? And quite frankly, there's not a police officer yet that believes this should have been charged.
Well, I can hear someone saying, well, maybe police officers should think twice about pulling people over because disproportionately African Americans are pulled over for things like traffic violations, brake lights.
You know, it's a fine line. Police officers aren't the ones that set the laws, but these are the ways that a police officer can help clean up an area that's a problem area. In this particular case, we know that Officer Yanez used it as a pretext stop to determine if he really did think that might be a person that fits the description of the robbery suspect.
There was a robbery in the area. But what you just said confirms what a lot of people in the community think, that these are stops with some other suspicion in mind, that these people are being stopped not because of a brake light, but because it's assumed that they are doing something else. And when you have that mindset, that you're going to be more prepared to shoot.
Do the general public think that sometimes? Absolutely. My wonder is if that same community would also question afterwards if that had been the robbery suspect and later on did another robbery where somebody was killed or hurt and they find out that Officer Yanez hadn't stopped that car. What would they be judging then? It's a very tough decision to make.
Oh, there are tough questions everywhere here. I mean, you say, for instance, that you don't think this should have gone to trial to begin with, but wouldn't that have been even worse if people saw that video and have their own governor, Governor Dayton, go on television and say if Castile, Philando Castile, had been white, he wouldn't have been shot and there had been no trial?
Yeah, what Governor Dayton said was irresponsible. He knew no details. I was just shocked that they charged this case. Let's go after the bad cops. Let's go after the cops that make big errors. I don't see an error here. As insensitive as that sounds, it was a perception of Officer Yanez. And whether or not he was reaching for the gun, we do know he was reaching in the area of the gun. And that's where the Supreme Court allows police officers to reasonably defend themselves. And that's the perception that the defense went on. And that's what the perception Yanez says he had the night of.
What's been going on within the police community that's trying to support Yanez's family? We reported on a group, MinSoul, or Minnesota Supporting Our Law Enforcement. They started a YouCaring page to fundraise for Officer Yanez's family. It was taken down. They talked them into putting it back up. But we also hear that members of this group and others that just support the police are talking about taking stickers and labels off their cars. They're getting threats.
I've spoken to both the groups, Backing the Blue Line and MinSoul.
Yeah, Backing the Blue Line is a nonprofit of police wives.
Correct. Both of them have reported they've needed to remove bumper stickers and any markings. After this incident, one of the individuals from one of the groups actually had the lug nuts loosened on their car. So it's been pretty scary for those families.
Well, there have been death threats.
Yes.
And you've had some.
I get them almost every day.
So what has to change here? You don't think that it's an issue of African Americans? Many in the African American community certainly do. The Justice Department in different investigations certainly does. The statistics seem to bear that out. And the money paid out from Michael Brown in Ferguson, $1.5 million settlement. Walter Scott, $6.5 million. This was the man in South Carolina who was running away after a traffic stop back to the officer's shot. Freddie Gray, Eric Garner, millions, millions. And it's an admission that there's a problem. What do? You say you have a gun. Let's say you raise your hands and put your hands up. But then what if they ask you to get out of the car? You have to put your hand down and take your seatbelt off. I mean, it feels impossible. What do you do to heal this?
You know, the answer is let me upset both sets of groups. Both sides need to change. In no way am I going to say that police officers are perfect. It's hard to do a job when you go out every day and people look at you and sneer at you and hate you for what you do while you're trying to do good. And in no way would it be pleasurable to be driving around the street and feel like everybody's looking at you different because you're a different color. Both sides need to change how they react, though. You know, I tell this to my own kids who, two of the three are blonde, they're blue-eyed, they're very white kids, and I tell them, if you get pulled over, you turn on the overhead light, you turn off your radio, you roll down your window, and you put your hands on your steering wheel at 10 and 2. Yes, sir, no, sir, it's not about giving the officer respect because you like them. It's about making sure your intentions are clear, and I think that that's a huge problem that we have right now. We're so anti-police that both sides are going to continue to fight and separate. So to bring them together, we can continue to ask police officers to do a little bit better every day. But we're not asking the community. But until we learn to bring that calm down on both sides, I don't think we'll ever get a fix.
Dustin, I just have to say, you know, parents of children of color absolutely are telling their kids to do that.
I think in a different way. I watched a video that somebody sent me yesterday, and this African-American man with a beautiful little daughter, and he was recording what she says. And she's young, and it broke my heart with her hands up. My name is so-and-so. I have no ill intentions. I have no weapons on me. I get what he was doing, but it's not the same way.
I mean, it made you feel what? Like, don't tell this little girl that I'm going to shoot her? That, I mean, how can you not, though, if you're afraid as a parent?
That in there instills the assumption into that child that she's going to be shot because she is African-American. And I don't think that's fair.
Dustin Reichert, a retired deputy sheriff from Minnesota. Dustin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Dustin Reichert retired in 2005. In 2003, he shot and killed a man who first shot at him in a violent gun battle. He's been battling post-traumatic stress ever since and speaking about surviving PTSD. For more, and hear our story with a friend of Philando Castile who was killed in a police shooting, go to hereandnow.org.
Shares of Blue Apron began trading on the New York Stock Exchange today. The meal kit company delivers all the ingredients you need to make, for example, salmon and cilantro lime rice with peach and corn salsa. But in recent days, Blue Apron lowered the price of its valuation, and it faces a number of challenges, including the fact that it's not profitable. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She's in New York. Hi, Lynette.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. And why did Blue Apron have to lower its valuation price?
I mean, the big elephant in the room here is Amazon and its announcement that it will, it had bought Whole Foods. And so with Amazon's amazing ability to get things to you as quickly as possible and Whole Foods, you know, general reputation as an organic producer, you know, fancy foods, you know, some people call it a whole paycheck. The combination is Amazon's ability to keep costs low and expertise in logistics with just an incredible brand in the grocery space. So Blue Apron, it promised kind of the same thing. We'll get you organic food from medium and small farmers around the country to you as, you know, as you need it. So it kind of has a bit of a problem. Amazon might have eaten its lunch.
You know, but the other thing about Blue Apron is that another challenge has nothing to do with Amazon is that apparently more than half of new subscribers quit Blue Apron after 6 months. That's according to the research firm S3 Partners. Blue Apron's CEO Matt Salzberg was asked about that on CNBC this morning, and he brought up the many ways he's focused on expanding into new areas.
So if you think about on recipes, you know, there's opportunities in new day parts for us, opportunities with different dietary preferences that we don't serve today, different price points for customers, different, cooking occasions.
Can Blue Apron succeed by expanding into new areas, or is it just going to have to address customer loyalty at some point?
There are a ton of things that Blue Apron has to address, not just customer loyalty. The fact that it's only had one real quarter of profitability in the last couple of years. It has to address the fact that it needs to spend money on more fulfillment stations. It has to do a lot of things that if it wants to grow and continue catching share, which is the reason why it was attractive for an IPO in the first place. It was the biggest guy on the block. So yeah, churn, that's what they call losing these subscribers. Churn is a big deal for the company. They have to somehow figure out how to bring brand loyalty or create the right product mix for customers who kind of lose interest. The business is also very seasonal. So they need to prepare for the fact that, you know, during the holidays, people order less. During the summer, people order less. In winter and fall, people are definitely more into being healthy and, you know, they tend to be more reliable customers. Mm. So the company, either way, was going to have to, you know, do a delicate dance in terms of how much cash do we spend to continue to catch share, continue being the dominant player in this market, and also at the same time invest in the business. Now, even to bring it back to Amazon, they weren't really profitable when they were an IPO either. But at the same time, they were kind of the first.
Right.
And they didn't have to deal with a massive competition in the tech or logistical space. Blue Apron, you know, the hope that it had to survive, which was finding this balance of investment and and cash burn to acquire new customers, Amazon
we got to leave it right there, unfortunately, Lynette. But thank you so much, Lynette Lopez, Senior Finance Correspondent for Business Insider. The first term of the new Supreme Court session ended this week. Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed by President Trump, took the spot left vacant by Antonin Scalia last year. And Gorsuch has proven to be at least as conservative as the man he replaced. Joining us is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
So now that we've seen him in action, where does Justice Gorsuch fit on the bench?
Well, you'd really have to say on the hard right side of the bench. The Trump administration, and especially social conservatives who make up its base, definitely seem to have gotten what they wanted. Usually, it takes time for new justices. Even the late Justice Scalia, they don't come to the court really sure about the issues they've never dealt with before. But for good or ill, Gorsuch seems pretty sure-footed and pretty sure of himself. Vote-wise, his new best friend is the court's most conservative justice, Clarence Thomas, who is, in fact, a great deal more conservative than Scalia was. And they are often joined by Justice Samuel Alito, making it a threesome.
Well, give us some examples of that.
Well, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito would have reinstated the Trump travel ban in its entirety while the court reviews it. The court's other six justices, including Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy, they sort of split the baby, as it were, reinstating part and not other parts. The three, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, dissented when the court summarily struck down an Arkansas law that barred same-sex married couples from both having their names on a birth certificate. On gun rights, Gorsuch and Thomas voted to hear a challenge to California's law barring the carrying of a gun in public for self-defense. The rest of the court left in place a lower court ruling that upheld the law. In the campaign finance area, the two filed similar dissents when the court refused to hear a challenge to the so-called soft money ban contained in the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. And finally, in the court's major decision on religious rights and the separation of church and state, Gorsuch and Thomas went further than the majority. The majority limited its decision to requiring state aid to a church for the resurfacing of a church playground. But those other two would have gone much further, making clear that they're prepared to strike down a lot more restrictions on religious schools and aid to religious schools.
Now, as we said, Gorsuch replaced Antonin Scalia, who was also very conservative. But there's been a lot of question about what's going to happen to Justice Anthony Kennedy and whether he is going to retire. He has not announced that he will, but he's turning 81. What do you know about what might happen?
Well, I don't know much of anything, but I think it's pretty likely that sometime in the next 4 years, he's going to retire. I just can't imagine him remaining there. He's clearly thinking about it. He hired his clerks for the coming term, but he's not hired all four clerks for the term after that, which he normally would have by this time. Hmm. And he could still retire now. I think it's more than likely that sometime during the coming term, he's going to let President Trump know that he's planning to retire at the end of the term, contingent on a replacement being confirmed. And in the meantime, his vote and influence are the only things standing between a takeover of the court by the pretty hard right on most, though not all, issues.
What do we know about the cases that the court has agreed to take up in the next term?
Well, if this was a court term in waiting, and it was, because really you'd have to say that this was not a gangbusters term in any way, shape, or form. The justices sliced the salami pretty thin in a lot of cases. But next term is when the legal thunderbolts start again, with Kennedy likely to be the deciding vote in the very closely divided cases. My guess is that the most high-profile case will be a test of state public accommodations laws and whether business owners can refuse services to gay couples. In this case, it was a baker who didn't want to bake a cake for a gay couple. But lots of folks will care about a case testing whether the police have to get a warrant to track cell phones. And the partisan gerrymandering case quite literally could determine the future of American democracy and how it's conducted.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, since the founding of the Republic, there's been gerrymandering, meaning the party in power drawing district lines for partisan advantage. But in modern times, it's grown more and more prevalent. States increasingly in our very divided country are dominated by one party or another. And those parties, when they're in complete power, perpetuate themselves by drawing district lines to increase their partisan advantage. And they have the help of computers, making it much easier these days. So in recent years, the question has become, is there a limit to how much partisan gerrymandering is too much? And the last time the Supreme Court heard this question, Justice Kennedy said he was amenable to the idea of a limit on partisan gerrymandering, but he couldn't figure out a neutral test of how much is too much. Now, some progressive groups contend that they've come up with a test or two that would work, and we'll see if he buys it. My advice is don't hold your breath.
NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And now to California, where some people will celebrate the 4th of July on skis this year. Leslie McClurg of Here and Now contributor KQED visited the slopes recently in 80-degree weather and has our story.
Skiers and snowboarders tumble out of the gondola and buckle into their bindings at Squaw Valley Ski Resort. Lake Tahoe's turquoise waters glimmer in the distance. Nearby, a waterfall pours through a gap in the cliffs as the hot skies penetrate the snow. When Michael Visconti carves turns in the slush, a fan of water sprays out from underneath his skis.
It's a little bit like water skiing, but it's great coverage, so you can't complain.
This will be the fourth time Squaw Valley has been open on the 4th of July since the resort opened in 1949. At the top of a lift, women pose for photos in slinky bikinis, black lingerie, and red booty shorts. Yet it's Visconti's outfit that steals the show.
Well, I've got my signature zebra pants. I've got this sort of monster hat with light-up eyes and kind of pink fur. And it seems to be incredibly popular with the 5-year-old crowd who wants to know what kind of monster I am.
At the bottom of the run, Ben Johnson, Scott Harlan, and Chris Legend can't believe they're skiing in summer. But the bluebird skies are the highlight. The snow, not so much.
Sloppy, mashed potatoes.
It feels like a ice cream cone.
Thick and deep, mushy.
In the afternoon, I head down to the mouth of the Truckee River where Lake Tahoe exits. And I've rafted this section of the river in flat water on an inner tube, and it's about knee deep. And right now, it is literally white rapids just cascading, kind of ripping through.
It's too high to be rafting right now. The bridges, you can't go under them, so it's very dangerous.
Richard Sappho is a local raft guide. He means rafters would literally hit their heads.
Whether it's decapitation or a gnarly concussion, that'll definitely ruin your vacations.
The company Sappho works for offers trips down a safer section of the Truckee River closer to Reno. This year, Sappho warns his clients to hold on tight, because if they fell in, they could spend a long time in the icy waters.
Those rapids come alive, and the water is so high and swift that you might swim for 2 months.
The Associated Press is reporting that Western rivers have claimed at least 14 lives so far this year. River experts are studying the unusually high flows. Jeffrey Mount is a water expert for the Public Policy Institute of California, a think tank.
Our rivers are glorious right now.
Fresh water from the Sierra Nevada mountains is rushing all the way across the Central Valley and pouring into the San Francisco Bay, a few hundred miles east. The runoff is so powerful, it's pushing back the salty ocean to the other side of the bay.
So during this year, it was fresh almost to the Golden Gate.
That's much different than what happened during California's recent drought when runoff barely trickled to San Francisco. But this winter was one of the state's wettest on record. In some mountain areas, there's twice the normal amount of snow for this time of year. But temperatures aren't as cold as generations ago, and Mount says that's a sign of climate change.
What we forget is this year is still part of our long-term trend that started back in the early 80s of warmer-than-average winters. So as we continue to warm, there's a lot of consequences.
Warmer temperatures mean melting snow evaporates quicker, trees bloom earlier, and soils dry up faster. Though Mount says that doesn't add up to another drought, at least not in the near term.
If I was forced to bet, I would bet on a wet year next year.
Wet years tend to cluster together, meaning the odds are slightly in favor of another snowy winter. Meanwhile, skiers like Michael Albritton are milking this year's final days.
It was a party on the slopes. Wonderful snow. Had a great time.
For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Australian Cardinal George Pell, perhaps one of the closest advisors to Pope Francis, has been charged with sexual assault by Australian authorities. That makes him the highest-ranking Vatican official to face charges of abuse. The BBC's David Willey has been following this story in Rome. David, are you surprised?
Not really. We've known that Cardinal Pell has come under criticism in Australia for allegedly covering up the sexual abuse by Australian Catholic priests when he was the head of the Catholic Church in Australia. He was Archbishop of Sydney and held a very prestigious post. And he's also given evidence to this Royal Commission, which has been carrying on investigations for the past 5 years about alleged sexual abuse of children, not only in the Catholic Church, but also in sporting associations, other churches, and in schools. So it's been a very extensive inquiry. Yeah. And the Cardinal has given evidence in person and also on a video link from Rome a couple of years ago.
Well, this is Australia's Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. And now this has moved to allegations that he himself sexually abused minors beginning early in his priesthood. Who is Cardinal Pell? Tell us more about his role in the Vatican.
Well, Cardinal Pell is a very experienced priest. He comes from a town in Victoria in Australia called Ballarat, where there was a spate of suicides many years ago among young Catholics who, inexplicably, there seemed to be this sort of an epidemic of suicides connected to allegations of sexual abuse by priests. Investigations were held, and apparently nothing very much was done except to recycle priests into other dioceses. And the alleged events for which the police now want to prosecute Cardinal Pell took place in the 1970s, a very long time ago.
Yeah. Well, and Pope Francis became Pope in 2013 and brought Cardinal Pell to the Vatican to oversee the financial system there. He also appointed the cardinal to a 9-member advisory council group. This is a man with a big role in the Catholic Church.
Well, you see, what happened was that Cardinal Pell and Pope Francis, the former Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, got to know each other in Rome at the election of Pope Benedict after the death of Pope John Paul. And I think when the former Cardinal Bergoglio, now Pope Francis, was unexpectedly elected Pope, he looked around to see who do I know in the international church, and he thought of his friend Cardinal Pell, who of course is an English speaker, and the Pope, as you may know or not know, does not have very good command of the English language. He wanted somebody who had great experience, including financial experience, in a big metropolitan diocese who could come to Rome and try and sort things out, yeah, because the Vatican Bank had got into deep trouble, accused of money laundering.
Well, there are a lot of calls to remove Cardinal Pell after the first round of criticism that you mentioned, that he didn't respond to abuse cases when he was in Australia. And now the Cardinal faces charges himself. How does this reflect on Pope Francis?
Well, Pope Francis has set up a committee of inquiry into child sex abuse by priests in the Catholic Church worldwide. You'll remember the scandals began to erupt about 15 years ago in Boston, in the United States, when Cardinal Law was found to have been negligent in dealing with cases of sexual abuse among Catholic priests. And in fact, he was forced to resign and to come to Rome.
Well, of course, we know that storyline. And, you know, here you have another associate, close associate of a pope. What do you think might happen? Are people going to call on him to take some action?
Well, I think the international interest in the result of this trial in Melbourne, in Australia, Cardinal Pell is going to appear in court there apparently on the 18th of July, is going to be absolutely frenetic, because clearly everyone will want to hear what he has to say in answer to any charges that are brought against him. I think it's only fair to say for the moment that Cardinal Pell and the Vatican have strongly denied any misdemeanors on his part, and he has said that basically he has been framed by malicious people who've come out of the woodwork, as it were. The Pope, to his credit, has said he doesn't intend to make any comment at the moment. He will wait for Australian justice to take its course. Basically, Pope Francis has adopted the line taken by Catholic bishops in America, which is zero tolerance in future. I don't think one can say that this has been the practice of the Vatican in the past, but it's certainly the intention of Pope Francis for the future.
The BBC's David Willey in Rome. David, thank you so much.
That's my pleasure.
And we will link you to information about his book on Pope Francis at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.